Chapter 7. Flash Blindness. Work on the Lennon progressed at a juggernaut pace, and Julia Pemberton felt somewhat gratified. Much of this was due to the excellence of her engineering crew and Ezra's security team. While the Lennon's survivors also lent their assistance to the repair efforts, Julia found that their skills were quite lacking, and most of the time, they needed to be shown precisely what had to be done. Despite this, Julia had no heart to refuse their assistance when they were eager to provide it. Still, she had to admit to wondering how they could be so lacking in basic engineering skills and could understand why no repair efforts were conducted before the arrival of the Maverick. No doubt, the engineer's death had a great deal to do with their being marooned here indefinitely. Most of the work up to this point was conducted inside the Lennon to reroute circuits and replace whole conduits when the power surge during the cosmic storm burned out much of the circuitry around the engine core. However, with her engineering team focusing their attention on solving that hurdle, Julia decided she would examine the outer hull and take stock of just how bad the breaches were. While she saw most of the damage when they first arrived on the planetoid, she had yet to take a closer inspection to gauge how much duranium they would need to seal the punctures. It was a task she could handle on her own. Ezra's security team was mending minor rips in the hull, aware the major work would require supervision. Julia emerged from the ship, still wearing her Envirosuit after Nathan expressed his desire they continue wearing the protection, especially in the open atmosphere. Since so much about the planetoid was a mystery, the possibility of harmful contamination might still exist. Julia hated wearing them, feeling her body protest by producing tiny beads of sweat beneath her clothes, even though the temperature within the suit was supposed to be comfortable. Stepping out of the ship, she took note of the repairs being conducted by the Maverick crew and started skimming the edge of the large vessel, aware her tricorder was next to useless, and her inspection would have to be done the old-fashioned way. She did not mind making a visual inspection of the terrain. After all, she was an engineer, and spotting minor defects or major ones like this in the flow of the hull was her job. Besides, she did not mind escaping the claustrophobic confines of the Lennon for a while. She could not imagine how the survivors could stand being trapped inside that place for so long. Glancing up at the sky, she could see the faint glimmer of the Maverick in the sky and felt a pang of longing for the ship. The Maverick was her first command as chief engineer. As so many engineers stated at varying junctures in history, there was nothing like being the chief engineer of a starship. She knew that Captain Larrabee could have had anyone as chief engineer for a ship like the Maverick since she was probably the most advanced Galaxy-class starship in the fleet, save for the Sovereign-class Enterprise, but he picked her. Julia knew it was motivated by her actions during the Battle of Sector 001. As far as Julia was concerned, she had done nothing extraordinary. The chief engineer had died when engineering was hit, and important decisions needed to be made. At the time, she seemed the only one who could do it. The reward had been the Maverick, and no prize could have been sweeter as far as Julia was concerned. She loved the ship. She studied every written specification about the Galaxy-class vessels before even coming on board the Maverick. Even then, the texts, the specifications, and manuals were nothing like the reality of actually being on board. Julia was extremely protective about the Maverick and hoped things were not going to hell while she was down here. "Don't be ridiculous," she told herself. Lieutenant Chanu was handling things fine in her absence. Her assistant chief engineer was a competent officer, and she knew that she was only complaining because she missed being on the floor of her engineering deck. She supposed the spacious quarters and luxury of a starship were much more comfortable than the surroundings she had found herself in the past day or two. Perhaps when the Lennon's crew returned to the Maverick to take their medical exams, she would tag along just to see how things were proceeding in engineering without her. Walking along the hull, she took stock of all the damage and found nothing out of the ordinary. The breaches in the hull seemed to be consistent with the kinds of damage inflicted by a violent cosmic storm. She could see the fused edges of metal where the heat had melted it and the bubbles under the finish were consistent with radiation bombardment. The tears were quite extensive, and it was fortunate the ship held together as well as they did. While the DY-500 ships were quite sturdy, Julia knew they had several design flaws in their structural integrity and were prone to collapsing if assailed with enough stress. She paused a moment and looked out into the landscape, which reminded her very much of the lunar surface of Earth's moon. It felt somewhat disconcerting to know that there was air and gravity in this environment where everything about this planetoid should have indicated an airless vacuum. In the distance, there were the edges of mountains and craggy hills, covered with gray dust protrusions of rocks and pebbles across the plains. Glancing at her tricorder, she wondered if infrared would function on the device and immediately began making the adjustments offering that kind of scanning ability. It was hard to work on such delicate equipment when her hands were trapped inside these cumbersome gloves. Suddenly, a flash of light illuminated the screen with a powerful glare as Julia inadvertently short-circuited the tricorder in her attempt to adjust its inner workings.
"Damn!"
she swore angrily as her vision was flooded with bright light, and she dropped the tricorder on the ground. The helmet around her head made it impossible to rub her eyes and dispel the temporary overload to her optical sense. Blinking several times, she tried to focus her vision when suddenly, the oddest thing happened. In the distance, she saw what looked like another ship. It appeared on the horizon for only an instant, but it was enough to imprint itself on her mind. Julia blinked again to take a better look, but the vessel was gone when she did. For a moment, she simply kept staring at the empty space of land where a ship had been a moment ago and battled with herself at whether it had been real or merely such illusion created by the flash blindness she had received from the tricorder. Julia was not a person who dismissed things lightly and continued to stare at the horizon where she had seen the ship a few seconds ago. She knew she did not imagine it. The vessel did not display the vagueness that came with a hallucination. What she had seen came with definitive lines and form. She could tell instantly it was a light cruiser, probably Ferengi in origin with a damaged port nacelle. A hallucination did not have that kind of detail, and Julia, who relied upon what she saw explicitly, knew she did not imagine anything. Still, a hint of doubt remained, and as Julia leaned over to pick up her tricorder, she wondered if she was not being a little intractable in her belief that what she had seen was real. After all, whatever it was had disappeared, and the mind did play tricks on a person on occasion. Dusting off the tricorder causing the hallucination whatever, Julia wondered whether the trip to the Maverick should not wait. Perhaps a visit to Nathan might be warranted. Glancing up at the sky, she saw the arrival of another runabout from the great ship. The vessel was descending steadily, its landing point not too far from where she was. Julia abandoned her inspection for the moment to greet the new arrival. She could not imagine who else it could be unless it was Nathan coming down here to drag the Lennon's crew to the Maverick for their medical examination, having grown tired of waiting for them to go of their own volition. Tucking the damaged tricorder back into the utility belt of her enviro suit, Julia started across the plain towards the runabout, preparing to land. It did not take Julia long to reach the spot selected by the runabout Midkiff as its landing site. It was only less than 100 yards from where the Pearlman had set down, and Julia lingered a safe distance away as the vessel made its landing on the planetoid. Once the small craft touched the ground, Julia began walking towards it as its pilot went through the motions of shutting down systems within. By the time she arrived at the main hatch, it had already slid open of its own accord, and its lone occupant made its emergence. Thanks to the enviro suit, Julia could not tell it was Ezra until he greeted her with that usual suave voice.
"Lieutenant Pemberton,"
Ezra said with a smile, glad to see her. Part of the reason he was so insistent on coming down to the planetoid was that he could not stand the thought of her being here when there could be trouble brewing in every single mystery about the place. While his concern was for all his crewmates, Ezra could not deny he was singularly worried about her on a more personal level.
"I knew you could not stay mad at me indefinitely. Was it a woman's intuition that told you the love of your life was coming?"
Julia rolled her eyes and turned away at that statement.
"Love of my life. Give me a break. I was making an inspection of the outer hull."
"I will take that as a no."
"I would."
She gave him a look behind the glass of her visor.
"What are you doing down here?"
"Just keeping an eye on things."
He had no wish to make any accusations until he was sure he was right about his suspicions.
"The captain is feeling a little trepidation about our lack of information on this charming oasis in space, not to mention the odd behavior of our castaways."
"Yeah."
Julia had to agree they were a little odd.
"I can see what he means. For a bunch of lifers on a spaceship, they haven't got the faintest idea of how anything works. As far as I can see, a lot of the internal damage to the ship could have been taken care of before we turned up. Albeit there's no engineer about to make the repairs needed for the hull, but if I were stuck on this rock for all this time, I'd try to make the place a little more comfortable."
Ezra listened closely and had to agree with her on that point.
"I think it is also their determination not to come on board the Maverick for their medical evaluations has the captain somewhat concerned.
You think something is going on?
She guessed, taking note of the thoughtful expression in those sea-colored eyes.
Have I become an open book to you, Lieutenant?
He said with a bit of a smile. Julia knew he was flirting with her, and she could not say she minded it, even though she was still rather annoyed at his selection of a place for their first date. Still, she could not deny, despite that disastrous outing, she was still highly attracted to him, and that damn smile made it very hard to stay mad at him.
Don't flatter yourself.
Is it me, or are you more agitated than normal?
Ezra suddenly asked, taking note of the cheerful personality he had come to love. No, he was not admitting that yet. Carefor was a little surlier than usual. Julia's demeanor was always that of the optimistic. The cynic in Ezra found it absolutely endearing, which was why he felt so much for her and, on occasion, felt responsible for ensuring her view of life was not altered by any unpleasantness taking place around her.
Don't tell me I'm becoming an open book to you.
She frowned, clearly disturbed if the lines of annoyance in her face were anything to go by.
One I would love to spend a lifetime poring over every single treatise and word.
He said gallantly and more or less anticipated the look of sarcasm that crossed her lovely face.
Oh, please.
She grumbled and then declared after a moment.
It's nothing.
However, Ezra knew her far more intimately than she suspected and could see it was not just that. Whatever was on her mind preyed on her thoughts, and the security officer in him started to express an interest in her problem as well.
Julia,
he said firmly in a voice she knew to be one he used when speaking to subordinate officers, which she was, despite their feelings towards each other.
I am interested.
Okay.
She sighed, hoping he did not think she imagined things just as she suspected of herself.
I thought I saw something in the distance.
Ezra looked at her, all semblance of playful mischief vanishing, replaced instead by the persona of one of the best security officers in the fleet and a trained investigator that had no peer in the sector.
What, pray tell, do you think you saw?
Well, it's probably nothing. I shorted out the tricorder and got a bit of flash blindness. For a few seconds, I saw spots and colors, and as I was trying to shake it off, I thought I saw a ship on the plains about 500 to 1,000 yards from where I was standing.
A ship?
Ezra's voice became hard.
What kind of ship?
The intensity of his voice clearly indicated he did not believe she imagined things, and Julia was quick to respond, hearing the insistence in his question.
If I didn't know better, it was Ferengi, but it was there one second, gone the other.
Ezra did not believe in chance, and he certainly did not think it was her imagination at work. When they had first arrived in this location and observed the Lennon from orbit, the ship appeared to be in a state of severe dilapidation. The notion of salvageable had been problematic at best. Yet, upon landing on the planetoid and seeing the ship with their own eyes, they found the damage was nowhere as considerable as they were led to believe. However, for all of them, there was a moment when they were not entirely convinced what they saw had not somehow changed. Now Julia saw ships capable of appearing and disappearing in the blink of an eye. It was too much of a coincidence for Ezra to dismiss.
Show me where you saw this ship.
Ezra, it's not there now.
I would have thought you would like to know for certain what you had seen.
He returned, waiting in expectation for her to obey his request.
I do, but it's gone now.
Well, perhaps, it might choose to reappear if we go for a closer look. Lead the way, Lieutenant.
Thanks to the strange radiation emanating from the planetoid, there was no way Ezra could report to Buck what they were attempting to do. Although this was hardly a prudent course of action, the security officer was convinced Julia had inadvertently stumbled upon something of importance. Ezra had made a career of judging a situation, and all his instincts told them it was vital they learn the truth before it was too late. It did not take them very long to the place where Julia sighted the ship, even though the journey would have been made so much simpler if they were not forced to wear the cumbersome environmental suits. However, Nathan insisted upon it, and Ezra was not foolish enough to cross the doctor when the crew's health was concerned. As the Lennon became more distant on the horizon, Ezra could not help feeling a sudden chill run down his spine. Something about the Lennon upset his usual equilibrium, and the security officer did not like how it felt.
This is roughly it,
Julia announced when they finally reached the location of her phantom ship.
I told you.
She regarded the empty plain around them.
Whatever it was, it's gone now.
Ezra kicked a pebble at his feet and thought deeply for a few seconds, saying nothing as he considered their next move.
What exactly were you doing when you saw it?
I was trying to jury-rig the tricorder,
Julia answered in a measured voice, realizing what he wanted by wishing her to describe in detail the events leading to the discovery of that mysterious ship.
I was thinking maybe I could get it to scan in infrared since nothing else seems to work.
She hated being unable to accomplish the task because it would have been interesting to see if it could be done.
And?
I short-circuited the thing. It's these damn gloves. I couldn't get the dexterity I needed, and I got a bit of flash blindness following the surge. You know how it is when you're staring at something too bright.
And that is when you saw your mysterious vessel.
Ezra considered her words and came quickly to the conclusion of what needed to be done for them to see it again. After a moment, he looked up at Julia, who was waiting in anticipation of a response.
Can you do it again?
What?
She looked at him in question.
Can you recreate those flashes? I think whatever happened in the wake of that overload allowed you to see something I believe is still here, possibly concealed.
That's a stretch.
Julia remarked but saw he was deadly serious and found herself drawn to what he was saying. It was possible, if somewhat unlikely.
But can you do it?
Yes.
She nodded and then glanced at the phaser hanging from the belt of his Enviro suit.
In fact, if you give me your phaser, I can do a little better than that.
Do proceed.
He handed her the weapon without hesitation. Julia immediately set to work on the phaser and explained what she intended as she conducted her modifications.
I should be able to manipulate the phaser frequency to widen its spectrum to provide the flash we need. I wouldn't advise using it too many times though. It's still the spectrum of phaser energy, so our optical nerves won't be able to tolerate more than 2 or 3 flashes before damage sets in.
Understood.
Ezra nodded. He had no desire to harm his eyesight in any shape or form, but he was determined to prove his theory what Julia had seen was real. He was confident they were on the verge of a momentous discovery, and he was willing to risk a little discomfort to learn the truth if that was what was awaiting them. In a few minutes, she completed what needed doing and beckoned him next to her, so they could both experience the flash simultaneously. Julia aimed the weapon at the ground and took a deep breath.
You ready?
She asked, preparing to fire.
As I will ever be.
Ezra answered without any hesitation in his voice and as cool as ever. She admired his ability to maintain that facade of calm and wondered if it was just the job or the fact he was such a skilled gambler, accustomed to hiding his emotions from his opponents.
Here goes nothing.
She fired the phaser. The flash illuminated the world before them in blinding white glare, robbing them of all vision. Instinctively, they blinked to protect their eyes from the overload to their optical nerves. However, the effect lasted only seconds before they finally recovered their senses enough to notice their surroundings. What they saw was beyond Ezra's expectations. Even though the image before them lasted no more than a second of time it took for their eyes to recover from the brilliant glare, they knew this time it was no illusion. Neither of them spoke as they gaped at what lay before them even after their eyes adjusted themselves once and what they discovered vanished. Ezra thought they would see one ship. He was wrong. There were literally hundreds covering the landscape now they could see it. Ezra spotted the Ferengi cruiser that Julia had sighted earlier in those brief seconds. Several older freighters were in a similar state of dilapidation, an Andorian trading ship, a Tholian fighter, and even a Vorta-class Klingon bird of prey.
Oh my god.
Julia blinked hard, hoping she could make her eyes see it again. Not that it was really required. What had been before them was burned into her memory now.
I trust you saw that.
Ezra wearing his best poker face because he did not want to show her he was a little shaken. It was like a graveyard of ships, and Ezra had the worst feeling that the Maverick might share that same fate if they did not report their discovery.
I saw it. What the hell is going on?
I do not know. However, I do believe it is in our best interests to depart immediately and let the others know what we have found.
No argument from me.
Julia followed Ezra as they started towards the Lannan.
Some of those ships look like they have been here for years.
I would not be surprised.
Suddenly the ground beneath them heaved violently. The tremor was so fierce Ezra could feel it to his bones and caught Julia when the violence almost knocked her off her feet. Both of them struggled to remain standing as the earth beneath their feet literally tore itself apart. Out of nowhere, a giant fissure appeared on the ground and started running towards them.
Come on!
Ezra grabbed her arm as they began running to escape the calamity coming at them. They both ran as fast as they could to avoid being swallowed into the earth as the fissure pursued them, almost as if what was happening was not a natural phenomenon but rather a directed attack. The Enviro suits made it challenging to gain any speed, and Ezra knew they did not have the speed to escape it. If they were going to survive this, they would have to make a jump for it.
Take my arm.
He ordered and glanced over his shoulder long enough to know they would only have one chance at this. Julia nodded and felt herself being dragged along as Ezra jumped to the side of the fissure, trying to place themselves in a parallel position instead of being in front of it. The security chief made it to safety, but Julia felt air beneath her legs and her entire body weight dragging her into the depths as she lost her footing.
"Julia!"
Ezra screamed when he realized she had not entirely cleared the edge he did. Without thinking, he stuck out his arm and grabbed hers, holding on for dear life as her weight pulled him towards the edge before he managed to stop himself from joining her, suspended over the edge of the abyss. Julia dangled precariously in the air, with only his arm to keep her from free falling into the deep crevasse beneath the fissure. The split in the earth had halted, but the ground was still trembling.
"Hold on!"
He fumbled for his utility belt and produced the tether line that was an absolute safety precaution when spacewalking on the outer hull. Aiming the sharp point carefully, he fired the tether into the ground and secured himself as he started to pull her up from over the ragged edge of the rock. The bottom of the crevasse was so dark he had no idea how far she would fall if he did not manage to hold on, giving him further incentive to strengthen his grip. She stared at him wide-eyed with fear, forcing herself not to look down, grinding her teeth as she clung to the lifeline that was his arm. After what seemed an eternity, Ezra finally pulled her up over the top, and Julia collapsed alongside him, breathing just as hard from fear as he was from the exertion. Uncaring about how unprofessional it might be, she embraced him tight and clung to him for a few minutes, allowing her terror to bleed away by the security of his arms around her.
"That was too close,"
she panted when her heart had stopped pounding long enough to let her speak. Ezra tried not to show he was affected by her closeness because they were far from being out of trouble just yet, and this was hardly the time for him to be overcome by his feelings for her.
"And too coincidental."
Ezra stood up and offered her his hand. Julia took it gratefully as he helped her to her feet.
"We need to get back to the Maverick."
"If it lets us,"
Julia declared as the earth shuddered even more violently than before.
"We will no doubt make a most determined effort,"
he stated boldly when suddenly an explosion of sound filled their ears with a tremendous roar. The shockwave swept them both off their feet, and this time nothing would soften the impact of their landing. It felt like they were caught in the eye of a tremendous storm, and as they struggled to upright again, another sound became audible through the roaring in his ears. It was like the grinding of stone or the movement of something huge.
"Julia!"
Ezra grabbed the engineer and held onto her, determined they not get separated while caught in the grip of whatever was happening around them. He need not have worried, for just as suddenly as the gale force winds and mighty roar had erupted, it stopped, and everything was dead quiet once more.
"What now?"
Julia swore as she looked up from the crook of his arm.
"I think this is more than just a coincidence,"
Ezra mused, somewhat dazed as his eyes looked upward at something over her shoulder. Julia turned around and gasped inside her helmet. Standing before them on what should have been a stretch of flat plain leading back to the Lennon and the runabout was a mountain. Chapter 8. Missing. It was difficult to take stock of time when one was in space. Without that most basic measurement of linear time, being sunrise and sunset, hours could go by before one would start to wonder if the day was actually progressing or where they were trapped in amber. It was particularly prolific on the planetoid where the Lennon found itself stranded, even though it remained in orbit around a planet. It hung there in place, not even conducting its own revolution in the cycle universal for every stellar body known to exist in the vastness of space. The planetoid was a contradiction by every science they knew, and yet it existed, its mystery deepening like the vintage of fine wine. Although Commander Buck Wilmington's reports to the Maverick indicated everything transpiring on Lennon was going according to plan, he was by no means believing his own propaganda. Much of his words were to assure Chris the situation was nominal because his captain could be rather an alarmist, especially when it came to the safety of his crew. Not that Buck was complacent about the welfare of his people either. He was just as fanatical about keeping them alive as Chris, but just did not show it as much. He knew something odd was going on with the crew of the Lennon, even though they had yet to make any suspicious moves beyond their adamant refusal to go on board the Maverick to undergo their medical evaluations. Buck also noticed for a spacefaring crew planet-bound for almost a year, they didn't seem terribly eager to get off the rock that was their prison for all that time. There were other little things, most notably their inability to conduct even the most basic repairs to the ship's systems. Buck had encountered few private vessels in the past and knew their personnel tended to be highly skilled and multifaceted. Julia's engineering team had to show them how to conduct work on their own ship, and while he said nothing, Buck kept them under a close vigil because something about all this did not feel right. While he was supervising the repairs to the bridge, Aislinn was his constant companion. She was as curious as any 16-year-old who had never been beyond the planet of her birth. However, Buck also sensed she stayed by his side for an ulterior motive. Despite this, he did recognize she harbored feelings for him that went beyond surveillance. Her eyes sparkled when she listened to him speak, eagerly swallowing each word like a tasty morsel from a meal she could not get enough of. She wanted to hear about the planets he visited, whether space was really as vast as it was reputed to be and how she wanted to see its beauty. Yet she was just as reluctant to return to the Maverick as the others. Buck could not say he minded her adulation since the attention of women, wanted or unwanted, was very accustomed to dealing with in his life. As far as he was concerned, she was still a child and treated her as such. When Aislinn grew to adulthood, he had no doubt she would be a stunning beauty, but Buck had no intention of taking advantage of her youthful naivety. He did nothing to encourage her, even though he did not mind satisfying her curiosity about the outside world. He spent most of his time on the bridge, repairing the damaged sensor grid since it appeared none of the senior staff of the Lennon could do it themselves. Kellison claimed it was the job of the chief engineer to deal with such things, and with the lack of skilled workers out there, he had to be satisfied with finding personnel who could perform their individual tasks and not the work of an engineering crew. The Starfleet away team dined together during their tenure on the Lennon mostly because it gave them a chance to appraise each other on the work being conducted on the older ship. While they invited the Lennon's crew to join them, the offer was usually declined because Kellison claimed his people were used to unusual eating habits following their lengthy incarceration. Apparently, their way of coping with the boredom was to abandon the concept of any routine, including traditional mealtimes. Buck supposed it was not surprising that long-term isolation had affected them adversely, and Kellison's crew were probably trying to adjust to being around others again, he assumed for the moment. They gathered in the main cargo deck and broke out their ration packs. Buck observed the empty cargo had been modified to accommodate livestock. There were no signs of the animals confined within the area, and Buck did not like to imagine what would have happened to those creatures once the Lennon's food supplies had started to dwindle. With the Federation subsisting on a protein transformed by food replicators into the meal of choice, most humans no longer ate killed animals for sustenance. However, Buck supposed when one was hungry enough, it was understandable they abandoned that particular prejudice. JD was the last to enter the cargo hold. The youth seemed a little troubled, which always gave Buck reason for concern because JD's was his specific responsibility, and Buck could not deny feeling a little more for the boy than simple concern as his commanding officer. JD was a bright kid, and he was eager to learn. He also had a feeling he was viewed by the young ensign as something of a paternal figure, a role he never called on to play but felt singularly honored to assume.
"Something up?"
he asked when JD picked up one of the ration packs and sat down on a crate next to him. However, Buck noticed JD was making no mood to tear into the meal even though previous experience told the first officer JD had a voracious appetite. Anything that could occupy his mind to such an extent must be important.
"Have you seen Lieutenant Pemberton around?"
Now Buck thought about it. He hadn't.
"No, I haven't."
Tendrils of unease ran up his spine as he tried to remember when was the last time he sighted the Titian-haired chief engineer.
"She said something about inspecting the large breaches on the hull, but that was a couple of hours ago,"
JD commented, trying not to let his lack of experience make him a worrywart, but he couldn't help it. He worked with the lady closely the last few days and was accustomed to her checking in with him since they worked so closely with the repairs. The sudden silence from her, especially since their confinement area was so small, worried him.
"Have you checked outside?"
Buck hated it more than ever that the strange dampening field around the planet did not allow them to use their comm badges.
"Maybe she took a little longer than usual. You know what engineers are like when they get stuck into something."
However, even as he said it, doubt filled him. He had given every member of the away team strict instructions about communication protocols because of the peculiarities of this planetoid. Julia would not ignore them.
"I checked outside,"
JD answered, being as thorough as possible before he brought the subject up with Buck. Even though he had a close personal relationship with Buck Wilmington, the man was still the first officer and expected him to behave accordingly.
"She's not out there. I also walked to the runabout, just in case she might have gone back there." but she wasn't there either, and it looks like someone else came down from the Maverick. The Midkiff is there next to the Pearlman.
Someone else? Who?
Buck asked, since the captain said nothing about sending someone down when they last spoke during his scheduled report. However, he was aware Chris had a lot of reservations about the planetoid, and it would not be that much of a surprise if Chris sent someone else down to join the away mission if it were warranted.
I don't know, they weren't there either.
Well, this is damn strange.
Buck grumbled and addressed the rest of the away team.
Anyone been in contact with Lieutenant Pemberton?
The collection of muted expressions and shaking heads confirmed Buck's worst suspicion, and that bad feeling started to swell in his chest with increasing intensity.
I don't like this, Buck.
JD whispered now that it was clear no one had seen their chief engineer in several hours.
This isn't like her.
It isn't, and I'm with you about not liking anything about this either.
Following the discovery, Julia Pemberton was missing, as well as the officer or officers who came down on the runabout Midkiff. Buck promptly organized a search party to begin scouring the area for the missing members of the away team. As anticipated, the crew of the Lennon was eager to help, but Buck decided, for reasons he could not define just yet, it was best they remained in the ship. Giving the excuse the repairs needed to continue and leaving a few token engineering officers behind to complete the facade, Buck and the rest of the away team fanned out from the maroon vessel and began their search. He and JD made their way to the runabout, deciding to conduct an aerial search of the terrain to cover more ground. He did not want to alert Chris to the situation just yet, not until they were sure their concerns were not alarmist. However, Buck was convinced Julia was missing through no fault of her own. If he learned one thing about their chief engineer, the woman was too much of a professional to simply wander off.
Why didn't you want Kellison to help us?
JD asked as they quickly crossed the gap between the Lennon and the runabout.
Someone needs to stay behind and keep an eye on things in case Julia comes back.
Buck replied, not about to cast aspersions on the Lennon when there was no proof of their complicity in the lady's disappearance.
Who do you think came down?
He inquired as they sighted the second runabout in the distance.
Well, the security code will tell me who was on board.
Buck replied, intending to ascertain the identity of the new arrival.
My money's on Ezra though.
You think so? He's got enough security people down here, why would the captain send him down personally?
Because Ezra, apart from being the sneakiest son of a gun and it comes to card playing, is also the most astute investigator I have ever had the pleasure of working with. If the man gets a scent of trouble, he'll hang on to it like a bulldog to a steak. I know he's been a little antsy about what's happening here, so he probably wanted to come down and keep an eye on things himself.
So they could be together.
They could.
Buck nodded in agreement as they reached the runabout, Midkiff.
However, if I find out Ezra was here and they both went off somewhere without checking in, then he's going to be helping Julia clean the warp core with a toothbrush for the next week.
JD swallowed, hoping Ezra had an excellent reason for their absence but could not imagine their actions to be a deliberate oversight. Ezra was the most measured person he knew and was confident the security chief would not have taken off without cause. Upon arriving at the runabout, they activated the locking mechanism, and the main hatch slid open, awaiting their entrance. The roundabout was only accessible if the personal code of a Starfleet officer was keyed into its access panel. The verification process was a safety measure that prevented hostiles from taking command of a choice piece of Starfleet equipment. Upon entering the small vessel, Buck immediately called up the last personnel code entered and was unsurprised to learn it was indeed Ezra who brought the Midkiff to the planetoid. Despite his earlier words to JD about Ezra being negligent, in truth, Buck did not believe it for a second and knew Ezra was much too professional to behave so recklessly.
Okay,
Buck said after a moment's consideration.
We can't assume they're together, even if it is the most likely possibility.
If they aren't together, then what do you think happened to them?
JD did not like the idea of either Julia or Ezra coming to any harm. He liked Julia, who happened to be one of the few people on the ship who did not treat him like a kid, with Vin Tanner being another and Casey who really did not really count. Julia took the time to listen to his ideas when he expressed them and had singled out his opinions during the repair work needed carrying out on the Lennon. She made him feel as if he was every bit as talented as those lecturers at the academy claimed, even though JD was not quite ready to believe that yet.
In this place, who knows?
Buck grumbled until he noticed the concern in JD's eyes and realized the kid was still too green to properly handle the notion death was a part of life on board a starship and wondered what it was like to feel that young. In either case, there was no reason for JD to face the darker realities of being a career fleet officer just yet. He could stand to be given some time to grow the calluses they all did with experience.
JD, I'm sure they're all right. I haven't seen anything yet that has been able to get the better of either Ezra Standish or Julia Pemberton. I'll bet by the time you and I get done scouring the place for them, they'll probably be back at the Lennon wondering what all the fuss was about.
The first office gave the younger man a smile of confidence and hoped it would be enough. JD brightened a little, aware Buck was trying to make him feel better and was not so ungrateful he would allow the effort to go unrewarded. Besides, Buck could be right.
Sure, Buck. Now close the hatch.
Buck gestured to the main hatch of the runabout as he nestled himself into the pilot's seat and prepared the vessel for launch. One way or another, they were going to find Julia and Ezra, even if they had to turn over every rock on this asteroid. Unfortunately, after a few hours of circling the asteroid from the air, the two Starfleet officers were rewarded with little that could be considered a success. They conducted the search visually since the sensors were useless due to the dampening field around the asteroid. While JD was sure he saw nothing as he peered out the window of the runabout as it skimmed the surface, Buck knew it was easy to miss things at the speeds they were traveling. No matter how thoroughly he attempted to search, Buck could not admit the possibility they could have flown right over their missing comrades without the slightest clue. He only hoped the terrestrial search parties had better luck. Upon returning to the Lennon, Buck found the security team who scoured the area as far as they could, discovered no sign of either the security chief or their engineer. Buck knew Julia and Ezra could not have gone far unless an outside force carried them away. Since no one had seen anything to indicate that, he had to assume, however, they became lost in the barren wilderness beyond the Lennon. They did so on foot. Kellazin somberly informed him that after his return to the Lennon, Julia and Ezra could have fallen prey to the treacherous ravines or gullies littering the asteroid's surface. Many of his own crew had fallen into newly formed fissures or some other hazard freshly created by the unstable planetoid. Buck found it exceedingly difficult to believe the Tellarite made no mention of such dangers before their search. He suspected Kellazin might be trying to produce an excuse for the disappearance of his people, and that deepened Buck's hostility even more. As the time drew closer to the appointed hour of his following scheduled report to the Maverick, Buck decided he had no choice but to tell the captain they were missing two crewmen, aware of how Chris would react. Not that Buck feared his response or anything. It was just Chris had a tendency to take it extremely hard whenever they lost an officer, no matter how much the circumstances were beyond his control. He had been this way ever since Sarah and Adam had died. Still, Chris was his captain, and Buck was his first officer. The captain needed to be appraised of the situation, and it was Buck's duty to tell him. Like a man about to face a firing squad, Buck returned to the runabout to take the small vessel into orbit and contact the Maverick. Sometimes, a firing squad was preferable to telling Chris Larrabee they might not have only lost two valuable officers but also two good friends. Captain Chris Larrabee said nothing as he listened to Buck's report, feeling the tension run through his chest as he heard the words and allowed it to seep into his consciousness. Vin Tanner and Alexandra Stiles did not comment as the words echoed across the bridge, worsened by their attempts to locate the duo were more or less useless. Buck tried to sound hopeful, but the first officer knew just like everyone else on the bridge that without their scanning equipment, hope was fleeting. On the scale of the things, the planetoid was barely the size of the moon. But without multiphasic scanners, it might as well have been the size of the universe. Chris listened to everything Buck said, letting the words seep in until he decided. From the very onset, the mystery around the planetoid bothered him, and now it appeared there was good reason for his concerns because his people were missing, and there wasn't a damn thing they could do about it other than scour the place on foot. Chris almost wished they had a few bloodhounds to do the job since they were faced with a search on the most primitive level.
They couldn't have gone far,
Buck continued to say, trying to reassure Chris as much as he was trying to reassure himself. The stony expression on the captain's face told Buck he had done nothing to assuage his commanding officer's fears.
They're on foot, so we'll find them.
Chris nodded as he came to a decision he had yet to impart on Buck or the rest of his bridge crew. It was the decision he should have made at the start of all this. Instead, he gambled on a worthless wreck of a ship when it was clear there were forces at work on the planetoid beyond their understanding. Not to mention beyond their control, he released the breath he had been holding when all the opinions were made, and the report concluded.
Oh.
Buck, he looked up as his fingers relaxed from where they had been digging into the arms of his command chair.
I want you to go back to the Lennon and abandon the plans to salvage her.
But Chris.
I mean it, Commander, Chris said with just enough intensity in his voice to tell Buck not to argue with him on this point.
I want the engineering personnel and the crew of the Lennon on the Maverick within the hour. The security team will remain behind to continue the search, but I want everyone else off that planetoid immediately.
Captain, I don't think the survivors of the Lennon will agree to leave the ship behind.
I don't really care if they do or not.
His voice remained neutral, but it hardened even more if such a thing was possible. The bridge had gone deathly silent, with no one daring to breathe too loudly for the sake of intruding on the debate presently taking place between the captain and the first officer.
They are leaving if I have to send our entire security complement to remove them physically. Explain to them, Commander, this is not subject to negotiation. I won't risk anyone else down there. Do we understand each other?
Buck nodded slowly as expression bled out of his face.
Aye, Captain.
Chris hated speaking so harshly to Buck, but he had no intention of continuing this situation. He should not have risked his people on that unknown in the first place, and he was not making the same mistake twice. No ship was worth the price of his crew or the lives of civilians, no matter how stubborn they were.
Buck,
Chris's voice softened just so that his old friend understood the order was made from a captain to his first officer, with no personal feelings involved.
You know I'm right.
Yeah, I do.
Buck was begrudgingly forced to admit it was the wisest course of action. If he were the man in charge, he would be making the same decision himself. In some ways, he was grateful that he was not.
We'll be back on the Maverick within the hour.
Good.
Chris offered his first officer a smile as their communication channel was closed, but somehow, he knew it was not going to be that simple. A sixth sense told him that their troubles with the Lennon were just beginning. Chapter 9. Vanishing Act. As anticipated, the crew of the Lennon was not at all happy to leave their ship behind, hearing the latest orders from Chris Larrabee following the disappearance of Julia Pemberton and Ezra Standish. Kellison, in particular, was extremely vocal about the order to abandon the vessel. While Buck appreciated the man's insistence on salvaging his ship, it incensed the first officer Kellison could be so single-minded about an inanimate object when the lives of his crew might be endangered by remaining on the planetoid.
But you said you would be salvaging her.
The full heat of Kellison's tellurite origins surfaced in his face as he argued his point vehemently.
Yes, we did.
Buck reminded himself to maintain his calm despite the obstinate behavior of these people and their ludicrous attachment to a ship when they could all be in danger.
However, you must admit the circumstances have changed.
J.D., standing close by, could see the first officer was about to lose his temper with the tellurite surrounding them. The crew of the Lennon was witnessing the debate taking place between Buck and their captain with open hostility to the idea of departing the planetoid evident on their faces. Like Buck, J.D. was just as confused by their demand to stay. It was not as if they were abandoning the Lennon forever. They were merely leaving for the moment until it could be determined what had taken their crew members.
You do not know if the circumstances have changed in the way you have foreseen. Am I not to understand that Chief Engineer Pemberton and Security Chief have some kind of shipboard romance between them?
Considering their last date, hardly. Buck thought to himself but bristled visibly at that being brought up.
Yes, they do.
He reminded himself losing his temper would avail him nothing.
Then is it not possible they could be off somewhere together?
The ripple of outrage did not confine itself to just Buck Wilmington. The engineering crew who packed up their tools and were waiting to depart were similarly disgruntled by such aspersions cast on their very professional chief engineer, not to mention the dark expressions being given off by Ezra's equally loyal security team, who knew the chief well enough to know he would never indulge in such irresponsible behavior and took exception to the tellurite accusing him of such.
Starfleet officers do not go off somewhere while they're on away missions. Personally, I find your tone offensive, sir.
He didn't mean it, Buck.
Aislinn, who had been watching the exchange with everyone else, immediately piped up, seeing Buck was not at all impressed by Kellison's accusation.
Stay out of this, child.
Kellison shouted at the girl, and she shrank back in fear, giving Buck another reason to add to his growing dislike of the man's behavior from his actions to date.
Don't take it out on her.
Buck defended the young woman automatically.
You are out of line, and she's smart enough to know it. My people do not go wandering about, and if they are not here now, it's because something has kept them from returning to this ship. Now everything about this planetoid doesn't make sense. We can't scan it. We can't explain how it does any of the things it does, but it's here, and now it's taken two of my officers. The captain feels no one else should remain on the surface, while we are at a loss to explain what has happened to them. His orders are not made lightly and are certainly not up for debate. I am telling you, Mr. Kellison, we are leaving. I am not asking.
You can't take us off this place if we do not wish to go.
Kellison's posture indicated his defiance.
Under normal circumstances, you would be correct.
Buck conceded, almost at the end of his patience at just how more time he was going to waste on this point.
However, as you are all citizens of the Federation, Starfleet has the jurisdiction to remove you from a location if we feel that your lives are being endangered, so I'm afraid that you don't really have a choice in the matter.
You would not dare.
I can have a dozen security officers down here in a minute who will say otherwise.
Buck replied just as hotly. He was in no mood to waste time arguing this matter anymore when this should have been a moot point. While Buck would prefer not to waste the security team's time, he would be willing to get a dozen officers down to the planetoid just to make his point.
So you would drag us off against our wills?
One of the Lennon's crew exclaimed with pure dislike on her face as she glared at Buck.
In a minute, we are not abandoning your ship under any circumstances, but we are simply taking the precaution of moving everyone to the Maverick until we find out what's going on. This is as much for your safety as our ability to search for our missing crew. We can't divide our resources and guard you at the same time.
We do not need guardians. We have taken care of ourselves for the last year without Starfleet's help.
Yes, but I am assuming.
Buck turned a high-powered gaze at him, watching the Tellarite's reaction at his following words.
None of your people have gone missing like this during that time, or is there something, Mr. Kellison, you're not telling us?
Kellison fell silent abruptly, and at that moment, Buck knew whatever was happening on the planetoid was no surprise to the Tellarite. Kellison's reaction all but confirmed it. While Buck was not prepared to challenge Kellison at this moment, he was on guard about how much the Lennon's crew should be involved with the rescue operations. Now more than ever, he agreed entirely with Chris's desire to immediately get them on board the Maverick.
Of course not.
Kellison swallowed, trying to cover himself.
I merely stated we do not need to be guarded by your people.
Of course.
Buck gave JD a look that told the young ensign he did not believe for a minute the excuse the man had just tried to give him.
I will expect you and your people to be ready within the hour to begin transportation back to the Maverick. Am I understood?
The Tellarite bristled at having to take orders from the Starfleet officer, but Buck had given him no choice. Continuing to refuse transport to the starship would imply he and his people had something to hide.
Yes,
he replied, determined to save face.
But just you know when we return to the nearest starbase? I intend launching a formal protest against you and your captain for your conduct in this matter, Commander.
That is your prerogative, Mr. Kellison.
Buck was not at all intimidated by the threat. As far as he was concerned, Kellison was trying to save face in front of his people and was more or less an empty threat. Rescuing these people who were almost out of rations and supplies from this rock was an act of mercy, not abduction.
However, until that happens, I suggest you make ready to leave.
Kellison gave him a hateful glare and snorted through his porcine nose before turning on his heels and storming away. The rest of the Lennon's crew went with him as they stomped off the main deck. JD watched them go and did not approach Buck until the civilians left.
I didn't think they were gonna put up that much of a fight.
I didn't either, but it proves something though.
What?
JD looked at him.
They know what's going on.
The first officer replied, not meeting the ensign's gaze as he spoke.
Whatever is happening on this planetoid, they know all about it.
As Buck issued new orders to the security team in their search for Julia and Ezra, JD busied himself with helping out with the final preparations by the engineering team to depart the ship. As the technicians gathered their tools and collected any equipment they might have brought down from the Maverick to aid with the repairs to the Lennon, JD concentrated his efforts on the bridge where he and Buck attempted to reconstruct the destroyed sensor array per Julia's instructions. The crew of the Lennon was nowhere to be seen, and JD assumed they were gathering their belongings reluctantly to leave the ship. Most of the bridge systems were functioning after the last 2 days of repair, and JD idled through the log entries, ship manifests, and other data stored in the computer core. Much of the logs dealt with the destinations and port of calls for the Lennon 6 months before their unceremonious arrival here. The Lennon mainly traded with the Elysian homeworld, ferrying everything from rare spices to seed grain like Quadratrudicale and breeding livestock. In fact, according to the ship's manifest, the Lenin was delivering animals to Lizhia to establish a reserve when the Borg attacked. In the efforts to escape the collective, the vessel became caught in the cosmic storm that saw it being marooned here. The animals en route to Lizhia remained in the cargo hold, and JD ruminated on that information for a moment. It explained the livestock facilities in the cargo hold. Initially, they had assumed the creatures had been killed during the contamination by Bertold rays. However, the cargo hold sustained no damage. It stood out in JD's memory because it was one of the few places that escaped unscathed. JD supposed the Lenin's crew could have mercifully destroyed the animals if they had made it to the planetoid alive to conserve their meager supplies, since eating them was impossible, and some of the creatures were definitely not meant for that purpose. Among the collection was a Silurian minx cat, an exotic animal that used to be hunted for its pelt. JD hated to think such a lovely animal would have been destroyed. He would have liked to have asked Kellison about what happened to the live cargo, but at the moment, the atmosphere with the forced evacuation made that ill-advised. Still, he wondered how absurd it must have been to have all that live cargo when so many crew members had died. It must have been a double blow to Kellison and his companions. While JD shared Buck's belief Kellison was hiding something about the planetoid, JD could not bring himself to think the man would engineer the death of almost 240 members of his own crew.
Hey JD!
Ensign Antonia Stark, a member of the engineering team just as new to the Maverick and deep space assignments as he was, greeted as she made her way past the open doors of the bridge.
Hey Tony, you getting the last of the equipment in engineering?
Low man on the rung gets to do all the dirty work.
I know what you mean. It's no different on the bridge.
Sometimes, it was nice to talk to someone his own age who understood the struggle for acceptance around much more seasoned officers.
At least you're where the action is.
JD could not argue with her on that point. It was not bad being around such heady company when that company included the captain, the first officer, and every command-ranking officer on board the Maverick.
Okay, you got me. You need a hand?
He was aware some of the equipment could be pretty heavy.
No, I should be okay. Thanks though. Well, I'll see you topside when I'm done.
She flashed him a smile before continuing on her way down the corridor towards the engineering deck.
Take care.
JD called out as she disappeared down the corridor, pondering for seconds why he said that before brushing it aside altogether. This place was getting to him. JD was so cute, Tony Stark thought as she continued down the corridor through the length of the Lenin. If it was not because he was already dating Yeoman Wells, Tony would have asked him out. However, it was not in her vocabulary to infringe upon territory spoken for already, no matter how delicious his boyish smile was or how tempting the need to brush away that unruly strand of hair always falling over his face. Tony turned down the metal stairs leading into the engineering deck and descended deeper into the dimly lit bowels of the ship. She could not say she minded getting out of this old wreck despite herself. There was something about its gritty insides and its surfaces of dull gray that made her skin crawl. Tony, who preferred the well-illuminated cleanliness of the Maverick, could see little reason to salvage this dilapidated and obsolete piece of spaceship. However, she supposed the Lenin meant something to the crew since they appeared so reluctant to leave it and wondered what it was about this rusty bucket of bolts that drew so much affection. As she stepped onto the engineering deck, she felt a slight chill as she heard her footsteps clanging against the metal deck and suddenly became aware of how quiet it was. When she was with the others, the ominous feeling of the place had not been so apparent. However, now that she was alone, the shadows seemed to loom more prominent than before, and she felt her heart quickening in a fear a little. She knew she was being a little ridiculous, but Tony could not help it. Forcing away the slight flutter suddenly appearing in her stomach, she looked to the heart of the engineering deck as the warp core was situated and made her way there. Most of the work undertaken by the Maverick's engineering crew was focused on this particular area, and the last of the equipment was stored in one place for easy collection when they were ready to depart. Reaching the equipment, she quickly knelt down. She began collecting everything she was able to carry, ignoring the slight trembling in her hands as she wrapped her fingers around the tools and packed them away in their appropriate cases. Behind her, the silence was just as permeating, and Tony told herself again for the 100th time she was being utterly ridiculous. This was a spaceship. It had no more ability to harm her than the tool she held in her hand. Besides, there was no one on this rock. They had established that fairly early on. But Lieutenant Pemberton and Commander Standish were still missing. Her inner voice reminded, much to her chagrin, since Tony was doing her level best not to encourage the train of thought her mind was suddenly embarking upon. There was nothing to fear, and she was a Starfleet officer, for goodness sake. A voice behind her made Tony stand upright immediately and turn around. Her heightened senses were playing havoc with her fears more than they should. However, upon turning around, she found herself face to face with the Lennon's navigator, Janice Owl.
I'm sorry if I startled you.
Janice smiled at the younger woman.
I just came to get a few things.
That's all right.
Tony let out a sigh of relief, feeling a little silly for letting her fears get the better of her.
I was starting to think my mind was playing tricks on me.
The young woman confessed to the navigator, who merely offered her another enigmatic smile. Before Janice produced a phaser and fired. By the time JD emerged from the Lennon, the last security team searching for Julia and Ezra had returned. Judging by the somber expression on Buck's face as the young ensign went to join his commanding officer, JD guessed they had not uncovered any trace of their missing crewmen. No one wanted to think the worst, but it was becoming difficult not to feel that way when there was no evidence to disprove it. There was not the slightest trace of either Ezra or Julia anyway, not even tracks that might have given the others some idea of which direction they may have headed before they became lost to the others.
No luck?
JD asked Buck as he joined the first officer who was the edge of the group, staring into the horizon of the dead world, trying to see something past the craggy ridges and barren landscape to find their friends.
No.
Buck shook his head.
The search parties have looked everywhere and turned up nothing. You know.
JD sighed heavily, his chest constricting with the possible loss of his comrades.
Don't you think it's kind of weird that we haven't found anything?
Buck looked at him, something in his words sparking interest immediately.
What do you mean?
JD was grasping at straws, but something occurred to him he wondered might be worth mentioning.
Well, even if something terrible had happened to them, and I'm not saying that it has, but even if it did, we should find something.
The kid had a point. There was no evidence of anything to show what might have happened to them. Not even a footprint in the dirt. While this atmosphere had breathable air, there was no wind or any kind of weather that would allow tracks to degrade. Buck had no idea what he had stumbled onto, but he was sure it was important.
You got a point, kid.
I don't know if it means anything.
JD shrugged, unwilling to take credit too soon when it was merely idle speculation, not anything important.
Every little bit helps.
Buck gave JD his due even if the mood was less than cheery.
Keep making your observations. Enough of them might give us an idea of what's going on.
Thanks.
JD said, trying not to seem embarrassed, but he was always as proud as hell whenever he pleased Buck. Letting his gaze sweep across the group preparing to leave, he noticed not all of the engineering crew was present even though the survivors of the Lennon were gathered reluctantly together, taking stock of their belongings.
You sent some of the crew ahead?
Yeah, I want to get the engineering crew out of here first on the Midkiff, and we can take the civilians up on the Perlman.
The first officer glanced at Callison, and his people, who did not at all look happy at the prospect of leaving.
The security team will stay behind and make another sweep of the place.
And if they don't find Ezra and Julia?
JD asked, not particularly desiring an answer, but he hoped Buck might have an optimistic one. Buck let out a deep sigh.
Then we have to come up with another plan.
He determined he would tear this planetoid apart with his bare hands if it was required to find Julia and Ezra. JD looked around and saw that Anson Stark was not among the engineering crew members still with the main group.
Did Tony go with the others?
You mean Anson Stark?
Buck asked, trying to place a name to a face, and remembered a petite blonde who seemed to have a little thing for JD until Casey had come into the picture.
Yeah, I saw her in the Lennon when I was finishing up on the bridge. Didn't she come back?
No.
Buck replied, his brow furrowing because he knew he had not counted her among the number of the engineering technicians sent to the Midkiff.
Has anyone seen Ensign Stark around?
It was soon verified they had not. However, if JD thought things were bad with the apparent disappearance of Ensign Stark, then the arrival of the engineering crew who had been sent to the runabout Midkiff and by that extension back to the Maverick was soon to shed a new definition on the word trouble.
What is it?
Buck demanded upon reaching the returning group.
I gave strict orders for you to return to the ship.
I know, Commander Wilmington.
A somewhat confused lieutenant struggled to explain.
But there's a problem.
A problem?
Buck did not at all like the sound of this.
What sort of problem?
The runabouts, Commander.
The younger man stammered as JD cast a brief glimpse at Kellison and his people and noticed they were unsurprised by the sudden turn of events. If anything, they even appeared somewhat smug about it.
What about the runabouts?
Buck asked, sensing something terribly ominous about to run into them with the speed of a comet.
They're gone.
Gone? How could runabouts just disappear?
The runabouts aren't where we left them,